If the Greeks can be said to have mythologized their history, the Chinese historicized their myths. Tao Tao Liu. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. To any newcomers, welcome. I hope you enjoy this episode and you'll peruse our backlog. And if you're a returning listener, I do want to go ahead and apologize for the technical difficulties that I had over the weekend that caused this episode to be delayed. So, with that out of the way, thank you for your patience. Please like, download, subscribe, follow, rate 5 stars, whatever you know your app of choice asks you to do to support your creator. I appreciate all of that support. So let's go ahead and dive into this week's topic. I want to go over some of China's understanding of this period prior to modern archaeological studies and what they believed about their own origins in the past. To that end, I also want to discuss some general ideas from Chinese religion and myths. This will not be an in-depth dive into that subject. That's going to be more for future episodes. This is some general themes of how this is talked about in Chinese literature, especially earlier Chinese literature. As you might have guessed from the quote, unfortunately, there's not a lot of dynastic sources to go on. Very fragmentary, and we'll get into that a little bit shortly. First, though, I want to talk about a very common misconception or misunderstanding, at least in parts of the West, that the Chinese people didn't have a religion as we understand it, and that they don't have religion as we understand it. Generally, the popular thought is they really just worship their ancestors and didn't really have gods, spirits, demons, or things like that. Now, certainly, veneration of ancestors is very important in Chinese religion and in society, at least it had been in the past, but they did and do have gods, and there's much more than that they had. One reason the idea exists is that there isn't really a word for religion, at least in Mandarin Chinese. They have a term, zongjiao, that is used to refer to organized faiths, though originally it was just used to describe clergy members or specialists of any faith that may have possessed said specialists. The term is made of two characters, zong, which can mean sect or clan, and Zhao, which can mean teacher. So that's a very generic term to describe all religions. They also have Jin, which can mean faith, but it doesn't have to be faith in a specific god. It could also mean faith in a philosophical view. Stoicism, for example, though that is a Western concept, at least as we understand it. And unlike in places in Western Asia or parts of Egypt, religious buildings or temples dedicated to a specific god were not at the center of emerging cities. Temples existed, but they tended to be on the outskirts of cities or out in nature or near burial sites, which, as we've seen in a lot of places in China, at least on the Yellow River, they're beginning more and more to bury their dead on the outskirts of their settlements, with a few exceptions. But that is obviously going to continue to change, and the dead are going to be continued to be buried, or more and more commonly be buried outside of their settlements. Now, this will change to some extent in certain periods of Chinese history, but by and large, when temples are more central to a city or a settlement, they're usually maintained for exclusive use by elites, with common people visiting less central temples or smaller temples or partaking in Chinese folk religion and ceremonies and festivals in other public or private spaces. The Chinese term for folk religion, they've adopted, it's a combination of zongjiao and the term minjian. So it's minjian zongjiao, which is translated as folk religion. Min Jian is the two characters for people or civil, and Jian, which is between. So this could be translated as literally clan teachers between people. So that's the term for, like, you know, the more, I don't want to just say rural, but obviously you see it in less urban areas where it's still practiced today. Especially out in the countryside, you had less ritualized or less strict rituals concerning offerings to ancestors and gods. And you would see other aspects like shamanism be brought in, nature worship, totemic symbology of certain either gods or animals. So you're getting a lot of different views and traditions kind of not necessarily clash together, because in some cases they work quite well, but there's not a lot of centralized control. And there's, in some cases, a very wide variety of regional beliefs and traditions. In some cases, in very extreme cases, you'll have neighboring villages have completely different rituals and beliefs relating to some of the same concepts or festivals or things like that. So trying to impose a uniform faith and worldview over so many people and places, even in a, you know, as strict as sometimes Chinese society can be, especially in the past and in the modern day, it's very, very hard to do. And in some cases, especially in earlier days, it's virtually impossible. I mean, even this is CCP today, you know, they're communist and atheistic, but they don't try to stamp out the folk religions the same way they do with things like Islam, Christianity, or Tibetan Buddhism. Now, part of that is simple nationalism and xenophobia for foreign faiths, you know, and fears of those leading to regional revolts or divided loyalty between citizens. But another factor is that, you know, trying to do so would probably be very unpopular for, you know, a large swath of their population. And so in some cases, these are, you know, Han Chinese people. One of the ways that they try to suppress those faiths, at least when it comes to Islam and Buddhism in Tibet, they import Han Chinese people to those places and just try to outnumber what were the locals. So in that case, you can't import the Han to kind of supplant the Han. That doesn't make a lot of sense. But that's a little bit of a digression. We'll get back to the mythology and religion now. Now, the earliest Chinese writing comes from the Shang Dynasty, which ruled around 1600 BC to around 1046 BC. Now, there are older characters written on things like pottery, though they can't be entirely read, or in some cases, they're just pictures. So, you know, you'll see something like an axe or a hoe or something like that, and you know that's what that is, but what was the word they used for that? Was it the Chinese word? It could be a language that's no longer spoken. It could be a language that was supplanted by the Chinese. Because in some cases, those earlier pictographs are completely replaced by the Shang time by something that looks different. So it's a matter of debate. But the earliest readable, recognizable Chinese writing comes from Shang sources. Now, at the date this is being written down, like other early adopters of written languages, not very many people can read. And that's going to be the case for quite a while. So most knowledge of Chinese religion and myths and history at this point in time and afterwards is carried on by oral tradition. Even as writing becomes more widespread, that is still the primary mode of knowledge transmission. Because China is a very, very literate society very early on. But even in terms of their population, it's still a relatively small number of people who can read or write to a great extent. All that said, I would still be willing to bet that at least some aspect of some of these gods or spirits, or what have you, would have been present at some of the sites we talked about this season. And while the conceptions of them certainly evolved over time, these figures were believed by the ancient Chinese to have lived at the times we've been discussing. And so they make up a valuable resource in how China understood its own development and history. And in fact, early thinkers of organized Chinese schools of thought incorporated parts of these myths into their worldview and tried to probably bring in standardize these stories and myths as best they could. Now, part of that is, I'm sure genuine, intellectual curiosity and them trying to, record that, people's oral traditions and knowledge. That said, we do know one of the big sources that we have is the records of the Grand Historian, which is written during the Han Dynasty. It's written by a man known as Sima Qian and his father Sima Tan. And he straight up says, I think in one of the sections, he says that, he went around and talked to several people, but he did include things that would only be appropriate, I guess, for, the gentlemanly scholar class of the imperial court of the Western Han Dynasty. So, he's taking versions of these myths that, are more acceptable, at least in polite society. But even he acknowledges that there are parts of these stories that either don't cleanly fit into the narrative or are just too fantastical for a rational Confucian scholar to accept. But he doesn't denounce them specifically. He just kind of praises the stuff he does include. That's very, very politic of him. Very interesting guy, Sima Qian, and I look forward to talking about him quite a bit. He's one of my favorite historical authors. Another big source, also from the Han Dynasty, that is very influential in our understanding of, the transmission of Chinese oral myths into writing is the Huainanzi, which was written by a scholar, Liu An, who is actually a member of the Han imperial family. I think he was the grandson of the first Han emperor, and he presented, his cousin, the emperor at the time, kind of this compilation of a number of different stories in this book. And it has, Taoist thought, it has Confucian thought, Maoist, a number of different philosophical schools are all kind of referenced and kind of explored. And it also talks about myth and folk religion as well. And in fact, the first thing I'm going to cite is a brief excerpt of the version of creation that he lists. And this translation is done by Tao Tao Liu, who is the author I quoted at the start of this episode. And I've been reading his book, The Chinese Myths, A Guide to the Gods and Legends. It's a very good book. I recommend it if you can find it. I paid about $20 for it, brand new hardback. I think it's well worth it. If you can find it cheaper, great, but I think $20 is more than a reasonable price for this book. Long ago, before heaven and earth existed, there were only images and no forms. All was obscure and dark, vague and unclear, shapeless and formless, with nothing able to enter or escape. There were two gods born of the darkness, ones that made heaven and earth. So vast that no one knew where they would end, so broad that no one knew where they would stop. They divided into yin and yang. They separated into the eight cardinal directions, the soft yin and the hard yang, formed, and myriad things took shape. The turbid became the creatures of the world, and the lighter became humans. And he goes on to kind of expand on this, but qi, which is the energy of all things, the animating force of both nature and man, it's a combination of this light and the dark, the yin and the yang, in their physical forms, and these are formed from the gods of heaven and earth, who are unnamed in this excerpt. But they kind of give up their bodies to form all of creation. But also, their spirits are living on and animating everything. Now, this is a very simplified version. It's a very short version. But there is another version that kind of plays with part of this myth as well. And it's one that I think is a little bit more important in the folk religion setting. Though, again, it does have some acceptance as part of, like, you know, the imperial cult and the worship of ancestors and things like that. And that involves the god known as Pangu, or Pangku, depending on the pronunciation. Now, in the Pangu version of the myth, heaven and earth are in kind of a cosmic egg, is what it's referred to as. And they're mixed together in this kind of miasma or sludge, essentially. But between these two churning forces, Pangu is born. And eventually, Pangu breaks out of the cosmic egg, and he separates heaven from earth. And he lays down between them, and every day for 18,000 years, he's resting between them. And every day, heaven gets 10 feet taller, Pangu gets 10 feet taller, and the earth gets 10 feet deeper. But after this period of 18,000 years, heaven and earth are formally, permanently separated from each other. Yang became the heaven, and Yin became the earth. And, you know, as he grew, he becomes smarter, wiser, and so he has the knowledge and of heaven, but it eventually his knowledge and wisdom surpasses heaven, and his physical abilities surpass that of the earth. For another 18,000 years, he essentially kind of rests after separating these. So about 36,000 years for Pangu. When he dies, his body becomes different parts of the universe. His breath becomes the air and the wind and the clouds. His voice becomes thunder. His left eye becomes the sun, his right eye the moon, and his limbs become the four cardinal directions and numerous mountains. His blood becomes rivers and seas, and his other features becomes different aspects of the earth. And his hair becomes parts of the stars and the heavens. Now, that is a very simplified version of the myth. There are other versions where he separates heaven and earth very violently with an axe. There are other versions where he first transforms into a pillar to, like, force them apart before, you know, turning back into a man and or a humanoid figure, and then, then giving the rest of his body and essence to finish creation, essentially. Very interesting parallels between the story of Pangu and the Norse myth of Odin and his brothers creating the earth and, you know, things from their killing of a frost giant. Now, Pangu's, at least as far as we know, the earliest written records of Pangu don't show up until the 3rd century AD. So this is after the compilation of the Huainanzi, or the records of the Grand Historian. So I wonder if maybe there's a little bit of maybe some cultural transmission between stories of, like, a giant's body, being used to create the earth and life. I wonder if there's a little bit of cultural transmission from maybe somewhere along the steppe. 3rd century China is dealing with a lot of incoming peoples from the from what is now Mongolia and Central Asia, and I do wonder, you know, if some aspects of Pangu's myth kind of incorporated those stories. But I otherwise, it's just a hell of a coincidence. I don't know. And unfortunately, we don't have the original sources that first wrote that first mentioned Pengu in a written sense. We have excerpts from it that were quoted by later authors, but the original story that was written down, it was written down by a Taoist philosopher, and I did not write that book down. Forgive me, but I wonder if he's if they combined aspects of an older version of Pengu with this new giant, maybe to kind of syncretize with these steppe nomads that are coming in and influencing China very heavily, politically, economically, militarily. That is something I will need to look into. But as you might imagine, Pengu being a crater god, a very important figure. There are several temples dedicated to him that exist even today. You know, at the very least, he is like one of the big ancestors of, not necessarily ancestor, but, you know, he's a very important figure for creating the world and sacrificing so much of himself to bring existence into being. And another thing that might point to this kind of later, maybe, changes to the Pengu myth is that there is another god that is sometimes attributed with the creation of life. And this is, he is known as Fu Shi. Sometimes he is depicted as doing this with his twin sister Nuwa, who was also his wife. Though there are also versions of the myth where Fu Shi does this alone. Or that he is married to another goddess, who is also his daughter, who becomes the spirit of the Luo River, Mi Fei. Now, this is just a way to say there's a lot of different versions. Again, this is that regional variation we're talking about. So it's very kind of confusing to sit down and kind of break this all down. But Fu Shi and Nuwa, when they are depicted, they're usually depicted as human snakes. Like, they have the upper bodies of humans, but they have long snake-like tails. So that is something you'll sometimes see them depicted with. Sometimes they're depicted more just as humans. Now, Nuwa, we do know that she appears on some Shang writing. She is mentioned by name. So there is a possibility that she was a separate goddess, or maybe Fu Shi is just not present on the remains of the writing we found. It's hard to say. In versions of the myth that incorporate Pengu as like an ancestor of Fu Shi, he basically, when he dies, one of the beings he gives birth to with his sacrifice and death is Hua Zhu. And she is a kind of mother goddess, and she is the mother of Fu Shi and Nuwa. So there are a couple of different versions of that. Now, these two, of course, you know, they give birth to, you know, a numerous generation of gods in some versions. They also, you know, create humanity. They're ancestors of humanity in some versions of the stories. All of that kind of stuff. In some chronologies, you'll see Fu Shi and Nuwa be in the later generations. Like, they're one of the first groups of sovereigns of humanity. And they're placed like a very, you know, they're placed at basically the earliest portion of Chinese history. They're grouped together with as the three sovereigns and five emperors. And these include some people we'll talk about later. I'm not going to include too much about them because we'll talk about them more when we get to that time period. Because in those type of lists, Fu Shi is dated as reigning between like in the like 2800 range, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe a little bit later, depending on your source. So I'll talk more about them there. Another list, and Sima Qian, he actually lists two different sets of the three sovereigns. You can either go with Fu Shi, Nuwa, and a god known as Shen Nong. And again, we'll talk more about them next season. But you also have his listing of an individual known as the Heavenly Sovereign, or as he's known in Chinese, Tian Wang. And he's the first legendary Chinese king. And he reigns for a very long period, 18,000 years. Or I should say he lived to 18,000 years. I don't think he quite reigned that long. But he kind of establishes order, if you will, to an extent. It's not quite the order that you would associate with other Chinese dynasties. In some versions of the myth, he has 12 heads. In other versions, he's said to have 12 leaders assist him, a family member, his 12 children. And he's the individual who essentially kind of quells chaos to an extent, at least among people. He divides the world for the many different peoples living in there, and he chooses kind of the best people to lead each tribe. He is succeeded as sovereign by the earthly sovereign, or Di Huang. Now, when Di Huang was born, it basically caused... I don't know if his birth caused the issue or if it just happened to coincide with his birth. But essentially, the sun, the moon, all the heavenly bodies kind of stood still. And there was, you know, real chaos in the heavens. And one of his achievements that presumably helped him get the job of sovereign is that he was able to reset the world into motion. Or at least reset the heavens into working order and things like that. And he rules for about 11,000 years. Once he dies, he is replaced by the human sovereign, or Ren Wang, also sometimes called the Sovereign of Man. And he is credited with establishing the Nine Provinces, which is the classical understanding of how China was organized. Now, that did not stick around all the time, but those were like the nine primary provinces. Eventually, it expanded more than that, or they got rid of the, you know, the number nine, but they kept the term province. But that's kind of like the classical Chinese understanding of their world, or the ancient Chinese understanding of their world. And that would be what the Zhou dynasty kind of also ruled based on. But he was said to ride a cloud like a chariot, which chariots did not exist until the Shang dynasty, so that's obviously a later addition to his myth. But he was credited with ruling for 45,600 years, and his dynasty lasted 150 generations. So very important, and he's kind of sets up the five emperor phase of Chinese history, which later Chinese authors will kind of organize into the Xia dynasty, or at least that's how they're described in the written records. And those are during, you know, periods where, you know, we'll be covering next season, or at least partly in next season. And I'll hold off on explaining them for that episode for next season. But that's just kind of a rough overview of what the Chinese thought was kind of going on at this time. This is kind of when the world is new and humans are learning about government and organization and agricultural and things like that. So I hope you look forward to it. But I think that will do it for this week's episode. I know that was a lot to take in, and this is a little bit shorter than what I was originally hoping, but I really want to get the episode out. And I did hit the high points. I wanted to also maybe talk about a couple of other guys, but we can include them, I think, for next season. But some of the things that the Chinese credit these later emperors for are things that are already existing in the period we've just finished talking about. Houses, for example. Then there's agriculture, which already existed, but some make the claim that didn't happen until later. There's, in some cases, there's kind of a condensing of these innovations to right before the Shang, Whereas, you know, in actuality, they existed a lot longer. And that's something that we'll try to thread the needle on in the future. I think that will do it for this week. I appreciate everyone for listening. And again, apologies for the late episode. If you have any questions, comments, concern, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me at email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X/Twitter. You can comment on the YouTube videos. We're at 293 subscribers on YouTube. I do stream during the week on YouTube and also on Twitch, where I've recently been monetized there for streaming. So, you know, hopefully earn a little bit of cash, put it back into the show and my setup and all that kind of stuff. So I appreciate everyone for stopping by. I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you're listening to this. And this weekend, we will be moving into Korea and talking about the developments there. Then we'll be moving to Japan. Then I think we'll do kind of northeastish Asia, and then we'll do Southeast Asia. Then we'll probably move into Australia, and then we'll move back to Eurasia, or Western Eurasia, and into Europe, and parts of Anatolia that I skipped over because they're more kind of, I guess, European-facing as opposed to Western Asia, though there are obviously influences from West Asia as well. But yeah, I'll see everyone next time. Peace.